This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point. When Florida's governor, Ron DeSantis, used taxpayer money to send 50 Venezuelan migrants to Martha's Vineyard in Massachusetts, he said he wanted to prove a point.
If you have folks that are inclined to think Florida's a good place, our message to them is we are not a sanctuary state, and it's better to be able to go to a sanctuary jurisdiction. And yes, we will help facilitate that transport for you to be able to go to greener pastures.
His move got a lot of attention, but it was mostly political theater. Those migrants were never in Florida. They came from Texas, where Governor Greg Abbott has put thousands of migrants on buses to Washington, D.C. since August and to New York City since April. Back then, Abbott told Fox News that the state can't cope with the number of migrants crossing the border.
In any one sector in the state of Texas, we have more than 5,000 people come across that sector every single day. And so, listen, we're full in the state of Texas. Our communities are overrun. And I started busing people to Washington, D.C. when local officials could not handle the number of people that had come across our border.
Since then, the number of Venezuelans crossing the border has only increased. In August, the U.S. Border Patrol intercepted more than 25,000 Venezuelans, an increase of 43% over the month before. So this hour, we're going to take a closer look at what makes this latest wave of migration different from past events. And let's start in Texas for a reality check on the situation there. Uriel Garcia is an immigration reporter for the Texas Tribune. He's based in El Paso, Texas, on the U.S.-Mexico border. Welcome to On Point, Uriel.
Hello. Thanks for having me on.
So tell us what has been happening, particularly in El Paso.
So starting late August, Border Patrol has been releasing some of the migrants crossing the Rio Grande from Juarez into El Paso. Usually what's been going on, depending on the nationality, some of these migrants are expelled immediately back to Mexico because of the emergency health order, Title 42. Right now, the majority of the migrants crossing are Venezuelans who can't be Title 42 because Mexico has not accepted them as one of the nationalities to be expelled into Mexico. And Venezuela and the U.S. do not have diplomatic ties to be able to deport them back to Venezuela. So because there's been an increasing number and the lack of shelter space, Border Patrol has literally been dropping off migrants into downtown El Paso, and some of them have been sleeping on the street.
So Ricardo Semeniego is an El Paso County judge. Here's what he said to the news website Border Report.
If I were to be as realistic as possible, there is no end in sight right now. We had 1,600 apprehensions last night. I think 18 before, and we've gone as high as 2,200. And then that fills the detention centers. Very few have money, and then others don't have sponsors. Most of them don't have sponsors. So this is an anomaly that we hadn't dealt with, and that's why it took us some time to address it to the point that we now feel we haven't released migrants to the street in 3 days now. And so that's a big accomplishment.
That was Ricardo Semeniego, who is the El Paso County judge. Uriel, that was earlier last week. What's the situation there now?
Yes, it's my understanding that the city of El Paso has been working to bus some of the migrants out and help them find lodging to avoid sleeping on the streets. So they created this welcome center as a place where Border Patrol can drop off migrants instead of in the streets. So from there, their city employees are helping the migrants get on a bus, usually to New York, sometimes to Chicago. catch a flight to various places. One of the places that I've commonly heard is Atlanta. And if they can't catch a flight that day, or if they're not going to New York or Chicago on a bus, usually the city pays for their lodging at a local hotel until they're able to catch a flight out.
And why are we seeing so many people from Venezuela? Talk about the specificity about these Venezuelan asylum seekers.
Right. Since at least 2014, when Venezuela's economy started to collapse, 7 million Venezuelans have fled, and they've been fleeing to various countries, to other South American countries, Colombia, Peru, Chile, and the U.S. is one of them. And the reason being, like I said, the economy collapsed because oil prices started falling, political corruption, and American sanctions on some of the country's oil and mining industries. So a combination of all those things has ruined the country's economy. And so many of them are seeking refuge in other countries and basically just trying to survive, trying to find jobs to do, you know, be able to buy food and groceries and things like that.
And do many of them have family members or other connections here in the United States?
No, because Venezuelans historically have not been coming in at the same rate as, let's say, people from Mexico or El Salvador or Guatemala. A lot of them don't have the family ties that Mexicans and Central Americans may have in the U.S. already. So when they're coming here, it's hard for them to be able to leave the border towns once they're dropped off because they don't know who to call to be able to buy their plane ticket or to be able to buy them a hotel or a bus ticket.
And you say a lot of these people end up on the streets, even though the local communities try to provide for them in terms of housing and other provisions. Why do so many of them end up on the street?
It's a logistical issue. Though historically, El Paso has always been a crossing point. It's been an issue of finding the infrastructure, the buildings to be able to house them, to be able to get them to the welcome center or to be able to pass on the message. So sometimes they just go by word of mouth and they just depend on each other and trust each other to be able to find the resources. So in some cases, they think it's just best to spend the night on the street until they can find a plane ticket or a bus ticket out of here.
Let's talk a bit now about the journey these men and women face in order to get to the border in the first place. Molly O'Toole is an immigration reporter for the LA Times. She's currently on sabbatical, writing a book about immigration in the Americas. And as part of that research, she recently accompanied a group of migrants as they made the journey from South America to the U.S. Molly, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
So who are the folks you followed?
So I actually followed a group beginning in Brazil. You have many people, obviously the significant majority right now are coming from Venezuela on this migration through South America, into Central America, into Mexico, and on to the U.S.-Mexico border. But you really have people coming from all around the world, and many people will actually begin much further south in Brazil or in Ecuador, two countries that have relatively liberal visa policies. So almost from any country in the world, you can obtain a visa. So I followed a group, actually, from Nepal, from Ghana, from Guinea, from Nigeria, from Cameroon. So actually people from all around the world. And then eventually their route will intersect with the route that many Venezuelans and others are taking from other countries in South America, and all of those routes combine to pass through what's known as the Darien Gap, which is a narrow strip of land that connects South America to Central America, one of the most dangerous migrations in the world. And so these people who are arriving at the U.S.-Mexico border, the very people that you were just speaking about in Texas and in other places, many of them, a significant majority of them, have in fact made this much larger journey. Mm.
And what are they hoping for, Molly? Is it to permanently relocate and establish roots in the United States? Is it to make money here to send back home while they wait out the unrest that's happening back home?
No, certainly. And you have, you know, sort of, you know, people who've been working on various refugee crises for a long time, and they will say this. I mean, increasingly, we're looking at a world. I mean, you have 1 in 10 people on the planet who are displaced right now. People are not going home. It's no longer a situation, you know, when the definition, the legal definition of refugee was first developed sort of post-World War II, the thinking was, well, this is a temporary status in which someone will eventually go home. And that's not the case anymore. And it's certainly not the case with the people that I've been speaking with and traveling with, and many of whom are Venezuelan. You know, they are looking to make a new life in the United States. They're very much motivated by the quote unquote American dream, and can't be shaken from this idea that if they simply make it to the United States, that their lives will be better, that their children's lives will be better. You know, many people are looking to arrive in the United States, you know, for safety and security and stability. You know, that does include to send money back home to family, but even those who are separating from their family in order to make this journey in the hopes of arriving to the United States, it's always with the wish of bringing that family to join them. And I did want to say that, you know, many people are in fact meeting family in the United States. And that's true also of the Venezuelans. Many of the Venezuelans who I've spoken to are looking to reunite with family members who are already in the United States or with friends who do have some idea of where they might be going. Although as people have rightfully pointed out, I mean, that information is really quite limited, and especially their resources are quite limited. So still arriving in the United States is something of a surprise for them and a shock often.
Right. Right. Uriel, just a few seconds left. How strained is the community in El Paso?
Well, I think the city government seemed to be caught off guard here. Ultimately, the quality of life of the residents go just about any other day, but it's the city government who is struggling to keep up with the numbers right now.
Uriel Garcia from the Texas Tribune, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Molly O'Toole from the LA Times is going to stay with us. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. Welcome back to On Point. Today, we're looking at the hundreds of thousands of Venezuelans who have come to the U.S. seeking asylum. And that journey to the border is just the beginning. With me is Molly O'Toole, an immigration reporter for the L.A. Times, who recently accompanied a group of migrants as they made the journey from South America to the U.S. That's part of research she's doing for her upcoming book. Molly, I want you to talk a little bit more about the Darien Gap that you mentioned. How hard is it to cross, and what did you see there?
It's almost difficult to articulate how difficult it is to cross the Darien Gap. It's one of the most dense tracts of land, a jungle on the planet. It's one of the rainiest spots on the planet. It is sort of disputed territory between paramilitary groups, drug cartels, sort of local opportunists. You know, there's a lot of finger pointing between Colombia and Panama as to who sort of has responsibility and who has control for this tract of land. And the way that the sort of the network or the mapping of immigration policies in the international community, but particularly in the United States, has essentially made it so that the migrants have to cross this way. That it's the only way that they can get from Colombia into Panama and then sort of continue onward using the Western Hemisphere essentially as a land bridge. to the U.S.-Mexico border. So it's basically a laundry list, practically. I mean, several of the most venomous snakes on the planet are in this jungle. You have jaguars. You have flash floods that can happen in just mere moments. And there were several days where we had to wade out the rivers because the rivers had become too high to cross. Many people who are you have to cross the rivers dozens of times along this journey. Many people can't swim who are taking mm-hmm. on this journey. There's a lot of misinformation and sort of lies and manipulation that happen, with people looking to take advantage of the migrants and sort of just, mostly just use them as walking ATMs. So many people go in ill-prepared to take this mm-hmm. journey, thinking it will only take several days when it really tends to take, at this moment, the route that people are taking, it tends to take 4 or 5 days to a week. So often people don't bring enough food. They're not prepared physically. They're not prepared mentally. People get lost. People get tricked. Any number of things you can mention. It is an absolutely extreme situation. And many of the people who are making this journey are absolutely desperate. They're exhausted already before they even start.
And aside from the dangerous terrain and wildlife and just the amount of time it takes, is there also a risk of other people, smugglers, for example, who could take advantage of these migrants?
That's absolutely the case. There have been reports of smugglers who will take advantage of migrants. So that, for example, they might take their money and then sort of ditch them in the jungle. Or they may refuse to take them past a certain point. But I'd also like to say that, for example, there is a sort of system in place. It's almost sort of bizarre how organized it is. There is also the case that there are smugglers who sort of treat this as a business transaction. The migrants want to get from point A to point B. They help them get there. They charge them a certain amount of money, and they're relatively sort of proud, actually, of the services they provide. They work on word of mouth and reputation. A lot of the reports about robbery, assault that happen to migrants in the jungle, of which at different times there were certain times last year where MSF reported Doctors Without Borders, for example, was reporting upwards of 80 to 90% of women who were crossing the gap were being assaulted. That was not the case when we crossed, and there was sort of a brief moment in which there weren't many of those reports, but often those reports it was indicated that some of the actors in terms of those robberies and assaults may have in fact been people from local communities who were in fact carrying out some of these attacks on migrants rather than the smugglers. Obviously it's very difficult to sort of pin down who's responsible. And if anything, I do want to mention what that sort of highlights is that no one is taking responsibility for what's occurring in the jungle. Not Colombia, not Panama, and not the United States, who's putting quite a lot of pressure on both of those governments in order to stop these people. But clearly this sort of idea of prevention through deterrence, which has essentially been a bipartisan U.S. immigration policy for the past, more than 30 years. The Darien Gap is such a perfect example of how that policy is failing. And this is the most, the deadliest journey you can make, the most difficult journey you can make practically in terms of a human migration on the planet. And you have thousands of people who are coming every day at this current pace. So it's an example of how that's not working, but no one is taking responsibility. No one is tracking those robberies. No one is really tracking those rapes, those assaults. No one is tracking deaths that we know occur almost daily.
I want to bring in another voice to this conversation. Joining us now is Nyerka Melendez. Nyerka is founder of a group called Venezuelans and Immigration Aid, or VIA for short, which provides support for newly arrived Venezuelans. She, her husband, and her son all claimed asylum in the U.S. back in 2015. They're still awaiting their hearing. Welcome, Nyerka.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So tell us a bit about your story.
Oh, well, everything started in March 2015 when I left my country along with my husband and my son. And then in almost a year later, I claim for asylum. That means in February 2016, you may be asked why I waited that long. It was because I didn't know I was fleeing my country, and it was hard for me to realize that I wouldn't be able to go back to Venezuela at the beginning as a regular citizen and being so active back in my country. I thought, you know, this is an unbearable situation, this humanitarian crisis in Venezuela, so this my pass Zoom, so I won't need to ask for any protection in any country, but nothing happened. I'm still, it's an ongoing situation in my country. So yes, in February 2016, we asked for asylum here in the US. I'm still waiting for that claim. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm.
And so what has been changing in Venezuela that has caused so many people to want to flee the same way that you and your family did?
Oh, I believe it's worse. The situation in my country is getting worse day by day, month by month, year by year. So what I think is that what I left in 2015 is just, in that moment, was unbearable. I cannot imagine how it's nowadays. Also, the violation and the systematic violation of human rights in Venezuela is the normal thing. You know, having no water, having no rights to express publicly your disappointing to the current regime is a dangerous thing to do back in my country. So doing lines to buy food is the normal thing to do. And of course, again, people seeking quality of life is the thing that the region is seen being the first weakness that is going on with the mass displaced, human displaced in the region, being Venezuela and the second after Syria, and acknowledge that we don't have that conventional war, but we mm-hmm. have a silent genocide that people is facing every time, every day. So this is getting worse. And of course, the proof is people fleeing my country, and the region is just being, you know, affected by this. Yeah.
And Nyerka, tell us about what support you provide to people who are making that crossing, and what have they been telling you when you meet them?
The reason that why we founded Venezuela was in 2015, we found on our way being forced migrants that they weren't many resources for asylum seekers. We were in first place understanding ourselves as asylum seekers, and we found in that moment not that much tools and resources to guide us how to do that. So my husband and I, after we got back on our feet on the ground, acknowledged, okay, we are asylum seekers, we have to know in which process we are in now. So we decided to connect people and deliver information regarding what to do and what to expect in this really complicated and complex process. So what we mainly do at VIA is provide information, connect people with the resources in the city that might help them, you know, resettle and just, you know, overcome all the bureaucratic stuff that we have to pass in order to wait, I mean, patiently, here, in this case, are two types of asylum here in the US, affirmative and defensive. So both, even though in one point find themselves in the path, still there are plenty of papers, evidence that we have to collect, and we mm-hmm. want people to be informed. And nowadays, of course, knowing the situation that is happening in the South, we know that this is more important than ever, being clear and informed regarding the process that we have to go through if we want to ask for humanitarian protection in the US. Yes.
Molly, is that tracking with what you're hearing from people in terms of the understanding of the process that they have to go through even once they arrive in the U.S.?
No, I do think that, you know, as she was pointing out, you know, there's a real asymmetry of access to information. A lot of people may, when I speak to them, you know, they do have this very clear idea in their mind that they're going to the United States, and they're going to the United States and they plan on seeking asylum once they arrive at the border. You know, many people do have a sort of destination in mind, at least just the name of a city or the name of a state where they might have family or they might have friends. But people have very limited insight into what is an incredibly complex and frankly dysfunctional U.S. immigration process, and particularly when it comes to asylum. I mean, there's a backlog of millions of cases. You know, I met people along the way who have made it to the United States, have claimed asylum, and their asylum hearing isn't for 2 years, their very first hearing. And at the time, at this moment, I believe it's an average of 2.5 years to complete the process. So many people have very limited insight into what they need to do and really what confronts them, the very lengthy process that confronts them once they arrive in the United States, that there's a long period of time to wait before you can get permission to work, for example. And the sort of lack of resources as my colleague pointed out, for asylum seekers, it's a very different process. It's a very different reception than the refugee process, for example, which is distinct and apart from the process of arriving at the border and claiming asylum. With refugee status, you apply from outside of the United States. You are actively resettled into the United States. Those organizations and the U.S. government in partnership choose communities that they think would be a good fit for people. They provide them with housing, with a stipend. Mm-hmm. It's a very different process. There's an infrastructure there. And really, for asylum seekers, they're sort of on their own.
I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point. So is there anything that would get Venezuelans to not try to leave, to not try to come into the United States? I understand this is very complicated. Nyurka, do you see any solution to stop people from wanting to come to the U.S.?
Well, what I see that this is going to be an ongoing and growing crisis because the core is still there, meaning the mafia, the criminal regime is still in the power in Venezuela. So for us Venezuelan, it is still not an option to go back to our homeland. So the situation is there. The regime is there. The regime is still considering us like, you know, enemies of our own country because we are speaking out, saying by our own testimony and example that it's a humanitarian crisis in our country. So what I see now is just a non-stop situation. Unfortunately for me to say this, because I would like to, you know, to see another thing. I would like to be able to go back to my country, despite of everything I'm contributing and collaborating in this country. Still, I would like to be the first one in the row to reveal my country. But what I see now is just somehow neighbor countries in the region, in the world, just trying to normalize what is not normal. So that is just the consequence of something that somehow for more than 20 years, people maybe underestimate, and now people fleeing the country is just demonstrating that it's nothing back to the normal in our country. So what I see is an ongoing, growing crisis of humanitarian mobility in the world and in the region, of course.
And Molly, speak a little bit more to that, the fact that the crisis from Venezuela particularly is growing and sustaining in a way we haven't seen with other countries. Is it in part have to do with the diplomatic relationships between the U.S. and Venezuela?
I mean, it's certainly a factor and a large factor. I mean, you have 1 in 4 Venezuelans who have left the country. I mean, I think in some part, this is coming, this sort of news, the way this has broken through into the news cycle is surprising for an American public because they tend to think of refugee crises as being somewhere else. But you have 7 million Venezuelans who have left, millions in Colombia alone. And the U.S. tends to be very, very focused on trying to stop these people, which is somewhat futile. I mean, for example, the U.S. put a lot of pressure on Mexico to change its policy for Venezuelans to require them to obtain a visa in order to travel to Mexico. Previously, they did not need to obtain a visa in order to travel to Mexico. Almost as soon as that change occurred, which was in January, February, then you started seeing significant amounts of Venezuelans going through the Darien Gap, whereas before they didn't necessarily need to. It's just an example of how if the policy is so focused on stopping people, that's sort of asking the wrong question in a way.
Molly O'Toole and Nyirka Melendez, stay with us. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
Welcome back to On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. The plight of the Martha's Vineyard migrants has reignited a debate about how people who arrive at the southern border should be treated and what we as a nation should do. Bilal Askaryar is communications coordinator for Hashtag Welcome with Dignity, a coalition of NGOs campaigning for fair treatment for asylum seekers. For him, the most urgent crisis is the perilous journey people have to make just to be able to claim asylum in the U.S.
What we are really fighting for is people shouldn't have to risk their lives crossing the Darien Gap to come and ask for protection at our doorstep. We should be able to identify the people who are in danger well before they need to make that journey, give them visas, give them the right paperwork, and help facilitate that through humanitarian corridors.
That sort of change to the refugee and asylum system is a long way off and would face big obstacles in Washington. So in the meantime, as migrants continue to arrive, what should the U.S. be doing? Askaryar says the busing by Governor Abbott is inhumane and cruel, but there is still room for governments to connect asylum seekers on the border with places across the U.S.
We don't need bad actor middlemen to be busing people for political stunts, but we can help identify like what communities are welcoming, right? We know that there's labor shortages across the country, and there are whole industries that are basically being run thanks to refugee and asylee labor, like poultry processing in Virginia, meatpacking in the South. Those people, their employers basically now just hire 100% resettled refugees because they can't find native-born Americans who want to do that work.
But it's not just economics that are driving communities to welcome and embrace new arrivals. Askaryar says that recent campaigns on welcoming refugees fleeing Afghanistan and Ukraine have shown the power of messaging and education around immigration to humanize people in devastating situations.
People don't understand the need for people fleeing to seek asylum the same way that they do with other populations, but that's on us. That's on our job to get those reasons out there better. when the need and the reasons for people coming to our country becomes clear, like we saw with Ukraine, like people clearly understood that Russia was the aggressor and invading this country. People clearly understood the need, you know, from Afghanistan, like my family was from, and we got here, asyled here many decades ago. People understand that, and so they can, and then they rally.
That was Bilal Askaryar from Hashtag Welcome with Dignity, a coalition of NGOs campaigning for fair treatment for asylum seekers. Niarca Melendez is still with us. She's the founder of a group called Venezuelans and Immigrants Aid. And Molly O'Toole, she's an immigration reporter for the LA Times, writing a book about immigration in the Americas. Niarca, tell us about the Venezuelan people you've been helping and how helpful it would be to connect them with communities across the country that would welcome them. Is that something you think they'd be interested in, or are they focused to going to bigger cities like New York City?
Yes. Mostly the community that we have been served, especially this year, and let's say even at the end of the last trimester last year, is people quite lost regarding the information they must know about seeking protection in the U.S. Especially this last month, people think that having that parole that they usually get when they cross the border means their asylum petition already granted. Some even think that that paper, letter-sized paper that some of them get when they cross the border again, is their work permit to work legally here in the U.S. So what we have seen is people totally lost regarding the information they have to know about the process they have to go through. So what we think is adding beside that, Welcome with a Dignity group is adding accurate information regarding the asylum process in the U.S. Not everybody, and this is something that we asylum seekers have to be clear about, is that not everybody is eligible because of the humanitarian crisis in Venezuela. There are laws that you have to meet some criteria. This is the federal law regarding the asylum here in the U.S. We Venezuelans, even though we are the second biggest human mobility in the world, we are not yet considering refugees ourselves. So we have in any country in the world, we have to claim for the different figures that exist to seek protection and then prove that we are eligible for that. So what we have been noticed with our community is that they are really focused on seeking the first aid, clothing, food, transportation, accommodation, but lawyers is quite of something that they are leaving behind. Again, first, because they think they have already everything done. I crossed the border, I'm okay, I'm already an asylum seeker, everybody says so, but they have to fill out an application. They have to send that application to the immigration department here in the U.S., and after that, proof and same evidence to endorse their application. So that is the big gap. That is the lack of information that we have seen is a big issue. And we, from our end, are trying to cover, you know, delivering orientation regarding that process. Yeah.
When Texas Governor Greg Abbott began busing asylum seekers to New York City, the mayor, Eric Adams, was there to welcome them.
As the mayor of the city of New York, I don't, you know, weigh into immigration issues, border issues. I have to provide services for families that are here, and that's what we're going to do. And that's what we, our responsibility as a city. You know, I'm proud that this is a right to shelter state, and we're going to continue to do that. This is horrific when you think about what the governor is doing, the governor of Texas, after a month of traveling across the border, placing on the bus with no direction, to come here to New York. And New York is a city that has always represented the democratic values and the values of our city, of showing our compassion. And that's what we're doing today.
But of the 40 or so migrants who were expected to arrive, only 17 came off the bus at Port Authority in New York. Most got off along the way. Mayor Adams says he was told they were afraid what would happen to them once the bus arrived at its last stop. So, Molly, what New York has said about people not having all the information that they needed when they arrived, or what Mayor Adams talked about the fear of what might happen at the end of the line, Molly, is that something that tracks with what you've seen from the migrants you've been speaking with?
I think from my experience in speaking with them, one of the most sort of devastating, unsettling, sort of traumatizing parts about this journey is the uncertainty, is the unknown. And it opens up that sort of information gap. All sorts of people who mean ill can fill that gap with any information that they want to in order to take advantage of them. So it is absolutely the case that they are so afraid. And, you know, they've often, especially for Venezuelans, but people from other countries as well, I mean, their relationship with their government is such that they're often fleeing. They're often fleeing, you know, political persecution, religious persecution, you know, violence, perhaps on behalf of a government or actors associated with the government. There's an incredible amount of fear. And even if they believe so fervently in the American dream and that the United States is different, you know, they're not strangers to the kind of rhetoric and response to migrants that the U.S. has given over the past several years in particular. So certainly fear and uncertainty is a huge part of the trauma of this experience for them. I do want to say that some people, you know, they are headed to New York, they are headed to Florida, they are headed to Texas. Some of them are headed to California, you know, often to reconnect with family members, to places that they understand there are economic opportunities, but that are also welcoming to immigrants. And in some of these cases, this sort of political theater has really backfired. And some of these migrants will say, well, this is great. I got a free bus ride, or I got this really nice bus ride to a destination I wanted to go to anyway. And so some of that political theater has sort of backfired, and that some people have found it helpful. Obviously, we know there are scenarios in which they've been misled and don't quite know where they're going and are very afraid. But I just wanted to point out that in some circumstances, people have actually been sort of grateful without necessarily understanding the political context, but just right. Knowing that they got this bus ride to a destination they wanted to go to anyway.
And New York, to that point, a lot of the reporting from my colleagues at the Boston Globe has shown just that, even though some of them said they were misled in order to get on the plane to take them to Martha's Vineyard from Texas. Many of them did not see themselves as political pawns, and they were grateful for the transportation up north. They were grateful to the people on Martha's Vineyard who provided services to them, and in Massachusetts, those who are still there on the main coast of Massachusetts that continue to do so. Is that perhaps, Nyirka, a roadmap to a potential solutions if communities can purposely work together to get people to places where they want to go?
What I see is people that are just looking a way to just, have a better quality of life. And if New York is the place, so let's go to New York. And they are, because of somehow they have groups in which they connect one another, because maybe they meet during the path to coming up to the U.S. So they somehow they communicate themselves. So they know now that New York is a city in which they can feel safe as an immigrant. Besides, again, I always want to point out this because it's the reality, besides the immigration policies, right? And yes, still seeking the community is a good thing to do for anybody, for any kind of nationality, in order to get, connected and take advantage of those who have been living in the U.S. for more years than these newly arrived people, could be a good point to start I mean, connecting and getting resources, tools to resettle. But again, most of the people that we serve, again, this is our own experience, is people that are just lost, and they sometimes don't know that they need to communicate at least a little bit in English. So to that point, is the thing that we see here in New York, people, you know, just waiting for help because they come with nothing, and that nothing in besides the first aid, again, clothing and food and so on, is the information I'm mentioned about. And yes, of course, we are here to let them know that here is a community that provide information and support, even with the peer support that we have with some psychologists that help us out with that because of the trauma that my other colleague was mentioned, which is something real too. But again, sometimes they don't know. We try to do comparison between our cities, busy cities back in Venezuela to let them know how could be living in New York quite, you know, overwhelmed for them. But again, making community is a good start. Yeah.
And Molly, as you mentioned, that this sort of political theater that the governors from the southern states were doing is backfiring, and that a lot of these migrants were happy to go to a different place and people were there willing and able to assist them. Is that a realistic roadmap to a potential solution? I mean, even in New York, Mayor Adams came under fire for suggesting he needed to house migrants on cruise ships because there were so many of them. Here in D.C., where I am, where thousands of migrants have been bused, the mayor, Muriel Bowser, also got some pushback when she called for the National Guard to help assist in housing them from folks who said that was treating them like they were invaders and not people seeking help. Is it too much to ask for these cities to be responsible for reaching out and making a place for these migrants?
I mean, if we're going to accept the premise that sort of people arriving seeking protection in the United States is some kind of problem, if we're going to accept that premise, I mean, we do have to look at, it's sort of like addressing a symptom, but not the cause, which is never to suggest that people are some kind of illness. But you know, no one is asking sort of why they're coming and how they're coming. There's just sort of this panic when they arrive at the border without acknowledging this sort of, you know, dozens of countries that they've passed through before then, and also what the causes are for them arriving in the first place. But beyond that, the U.S. can do this. They can do a lot more. I mean, they have in the past. If you look at the refugee program, which is distinct from asylum, I mean, the Biden administration set a ceiling, I believe, of 125,000. And I think they were on track to only accept 20. And that's sort of a formal resettlement process. The U.S. has a history of doing this and can do a lot more. And I believe that these cities can as well. I mean, we mentioned the response to Ukrainian displacement and to Afghan displacement. And I mean, if you look at the kind of public support that was rallied, but also the sort of fast track that they were provided, why is it that there is a difference in the way that the United States, from a political and policy standpoint, is responding differently to those populations? It proves
we
that
have to
more
stop there.
Can be done.
Molly O'Toole is an immigration reporter for the LA Times with a forthcoming book about immigration from the Americas. Thank you, Molly.
Thank you.
And Nyerka Melendez is founder of Venezuelan and Immigrant Aid. Thank you so much for joining us.
No, thank you for having me.
I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.